You're listening to a social justice podcast hosted by Nicholas Berling, brought to you by The Flag Shop, and inspired by a social justice coloring book. Hello, this is a social justice podcast. I'm your host, Nicholas Berling, and today we're going to be talking about decolonization through design with Kay Sugalov from Sky Spirit. Thank you for joining me today.
You pronounced my name amazingly. My name is Sierra Tassie Baker. My pronouns are they, she, and he, and today I'd prefer they, them. I'm gender fluid, two-spirit, indigiqueer from the Squamish Ochomeo. I'm also Kwakiwak, Muskumag, Zaldanok, and Tlingit, and I'm also a Magyar Hungarian. My father is Wade Baker. He's a master carver, and he represents my indigenous side, and my mom is Mary Tassie, and in her own words, she's an old-school urban planner, and she represents my Eastern European side. But yeah, I'm a Indigenous urban designer at Sky Spirit Studio, and I'm really excited to talk about design with you today.
Thank you again for joining. And you mentioned Sky Spirit Studio. Can you talk about what that organization is and how it came to be?
100%. So Sky Spirit Studio started way back in the day as Sky Serpent Studio when my parents met. And my mom, well, like she said, she was an old school urban planner. She was working in Toronto at the time. She was starting to get really frustrated with the really like patriarchal attitude. She started feeling really off and wrong about like urban design and the industry at the time. And she decided to just like up and leave. She was like one of the first, you know, women to have her own urban planning company out in Toronto, like at that time, which is just like, it's like the power suit era, right? But like a lot of like sexism in the industry and just like all that. And she's like, something's wrong with this. She started going to, she explained it to me, like AA meetings with, and that's where she started meeting a lot more Indigenous people in Toronto on the East Coast. And then she started getting more involved and more aware of like the real situation as somebody that her parents like immigrated over. So then she left the East Coast and then came over, met my dad. They fell in love, had like a whirlwind romance. I suddenly showed up unexpected, and they were like, oh, okay, let's do this. Like, let's have this like whole new life together on the West Coast in my dad's territory and in our nation in the village of Tlahan, it's called. And so I was raised in like one of our old villages, which has been now a reservation, in my parents' company. So my mom decided to move into public art and help manage my dad's art practice, and my dad is this incredible public artist. And then she started incorporating some like placemaking as well. So like, you know, like landscaping around like the either the totem poles or the gateways or like the figures and stuff like this, and supporting like the design layout of like the galleries and stuff when he was working. So it was really nice to grow up in this like collaborative environment and an entrepreneurial environment. So I grew up in Sky Spirit Studio. My parents were really like, oh, you can do whatever you want, sweetie, kind of energy. And then I decided I wanted to be an urban designer, and I kind of went and did my whole education. I came back when I was 23, and since then have been really working really closely with my parents to bring back the urban planning element to our design studio. And I got rebranded as Sky Spirit Studio, and we've been doing urban design really solidly now for the past 5 years altogether.
Wow. So you finish high school basically and you go straight into urban
my master's design. I actually completed my master's at 23.
Oh, wow. Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. So as soon as I finished my master's program in London, England at University College London, I went directly back home because like that's the whole reason I wanted to do education. That's the whole reason I wanted to like expedite my whole educational journey. I went into university at 16 and really determined. I was like, I want to finish this as quickly as possible and the most effectively as possible so I can come back to my community and use like all my time to actually like try and create this movement and try and support my community, which is its own story and has its own tribulations. But I really wanted to finish as quickly as I could and was really supported as well. And obviously I'm still recovering from the burnout of that. But I'm finally like after 5 years of like working and doing this like entrepreneurial life with my family, this family business, it's been feeling like really, really great lately. And like the work environment feels really great. And luckily I have a really good working relationship with my parents as well.
And looking at the homepage of your website, I see the quote, leading the conversation through ancestral governance. So can you explain what that looks like in practice?
100%. So ancestral governance, I'm using the term as realistically as possible. So I'm very fortunate to be descended from many different chieftainships and leaders from up and down the West Coast on my father's side. So we're descendants of Chief Shadatsa. We're descendants of the Seltun the First dynasty, for lack of a better word, on my Tlingit side. And we're descended from the Muscomog Zaudenok leadership through my grandmother, who was a high-ranking chief named Tlacogila Ogwa, Emily Nelson Baker. And she married into the Squamish Ohomeo, into the Kiaplanok family, which are known for having leadership in the Chemulchisin area, so Kaplano River kind of area, or like around like where Lionsgate Bridge is now on the North Vancouver side. And also different chieftainships and like alliances up and down the West Coast. On my Kiaplanok side, we're also descended from Mary Kiaplanok, and she's descended from many generations ago, a peace treaty between the Squamish Ohomeo, the Squamish people, and the Yukulta Kukwakiwak Nation. There was a lot of war between like Northwest Coast and Coast Salish for a long time, but our family represents some of those peace treaties between them. So I was very fortunate to have some time to like grow up with my grandmother and grow up in a family that's really involved and invested in ceremony. So really learning my place, like really learning the importance of protocol, the importance of ceremony, and how ceremony is a form of governance. And so like really, really trying to understand and like come to like a place of like very humble understanding of what it means to be from a family that understands leadership, but also how leadership isn't about, in like Indigenous way, it's not about having dominion over anybody. It's literally just being able to relate to each other, understanding each other's roles, like working together effectively and supporting each other's like spirits and supporting each other's like creative endeavors and stuff like that. It obviously gets way, way more complicated and complex than that, but that's the context that like I understand ancestral governance from, at least on the West Coast.
Right. And I mean, I obviously don't know what it's like to be Indigenous, but as a trans person, I know what it's like to be tokenized. Mm. And as you work with your clients, do you ever feel as though you're being tokenized in your work or that it's being used by others as a way to virtue signal?
Yeah, all the time. I'm very, very aware of tokenization and how harmful it is, especially when I was younger, right? Like coming into the industry at like a really young age and not at the time necessarily knowing I was being tokenized. I really thought I was being supported, but now I'm like way more critical. I'm like, wow, that like wasn't, you know, like such a nice thing for that person to do to offer me that opportunity. They actually benefited a lot more than I ever could, mm-hmm. Because of the way power dynamics work. And now it's getting really, really frustrating and really highly problematic in my industry, where less than 1% of people in the design industry are Indigenous. Actually, the real data is less than 1% of designers across what's colonially known as Canada are Black and Indigenous. Wow. So two demographics are less than 1% in any kind of position of power in the design industry. So spatial design being landscape architecture, urban planning, urban policy, public art, placemaking, and spatial design. I think public art's not part of that study, but we're including it in the conversations. But it's really bad. So no matter what you do, because there's so few of us doing this work, you're going to end up tokenized to some way. So what we're trying to do is really try and like answer, like, how do we do this work without getting tokenized? And yeah, it's a huge conversation right now.
Right. And why is it, do you think, that that percentage is so low? Because for people who aren't aware, like, that's a much smaller percentage than there are of Indigenous people in Canada as totally. A whole, right?
Yeah, I think right now the data is the Indigenous population in Canada as a whole is 5%, mm-hmm. which I think is also like not quite accurate, but that's the official data. Meanwhile, yeah, then there's like less than 1% in design, which is unreal. But I think what's happening is obviously colonialism and what's called redlining specifically. So redlining is the process of subjugating or ensuring that there's no representation of Black or Indigenous or people of color in certain industries to like maintain land theft, essentially. There's been policies and even laws that have denied people in Vancouver, for example, from Black or Indigenous people purchasing land in the West End. There was laws and policies making sure that Black or Indigenous people couldn't buy land in West Vancouver or in Shaughnessy, for example. And then there was like maps essentially defining where Black, Indigenous people of color could go. And a lot of that was the downtown east side. So then all the people like making these maps were not Black or Indigenous, and making sure that people in decision-making positions couldn't, you know, fight that or like speak up against it, because they knew if like Indigenous people, you know, were in charge of like land-based decisions, that's essentially a form of like sovereignty. And if you're exerting sovereignty, you're not successfully stealing the land, right? So
right.
Unfortunately, it's a very intentional process of ensuring that certain voices are making decisions and certain voices aren't.
And I mean, it seems like policies like that haven't entirely gone away yet either. Like, mm-hmm. I think about the conversations around gerrymandering, for instance, where mm-hmm. Different populations are sort of placed into one area where their vote isn't going to mean as much, essentially, right?
So totally.
Are you noticing that there are still policies like that in place that are affecting design?
I mean, yes. I wouldn't be able to like label them out on a table for you at this exact moment. Mm-hmm. However, one example that I found really interesting is when we're working with the city of Vancouver or with the University of British Columbia, for example, if you're, you know, working as a professor for UBC, or if you're doing a design project with the city of Vancouver, if you look at those contracts, they say that any work that you do is the proprietary right, like intellectual rights of the city now. Or UBC, same thing, like anything you're doing for them, that's, they own that intellectual property now, which is technically your intellectual property. You know, if you're, you know, white, I don't necessarily know if that's like as big of a concern. However, I think it still is concerning that that's the power dynamic. But then as an Indigenous person, if I agree to that document and say, yes, anything I create for you is yours, like everything that I'm built from isn't mine in the first place. It's my community, it's my family, it's my cultural knowledge. And now I've just agreed that by using this cultural knowledge that it's not mine anymore. That's deeply problematic, and we can't let that happen. So what we did is we asked for those contracts to be changed. And at one institution, it wasn't able to happen. So I'm like, I just won't work with them anymore. Whereas with the city of Vancouver, they were able to change the contracts to respect like intellectual property and like familial property.
Right. And I mean, that kind of ties into another question that I have for you. So I'm going to skip ahead here a little bit. But I recall in conversation that we had prior to the podcast, you were discussing that UNDRIP is a requirement of government design now, but that those designs don't necessarily have to be implemented by the government. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on what that system looks like and why that was implemented, why it needs to change, or how it needs to change?
So when I kind of like came back into urban planning when I was 23 and like really wanted to do this work in a real way, and it became really important to me and my family and other Indigenous people at the time working in these fields, so we have to change the conversation. Because yeah, was it like just 5 years ago, there wasn't any real conversation around including Indigenous people in the design process. There were already those conversations of like land title and rights that a lot of lawyers have really been championing for some time now. But the actual conversation of right, what happens when we get the land back? Who designs the land? Are we just hiring the same developers, but now we're just an Indigenous nation with title, hiring the same people that have been colonizing the territory in the first place? You're like, oh no, we have to change the conversation. So now people started talking about, you know, like land acknowledgements. What does it mean as somebody designing or developing on Indigenous land to acknowledge the land? Like you have to go like step further than that. Mm-hmm. So by changing these conversations, Ginger Gosdell Myers, for example, really working on like the city of reconciliation narrative within the city, people like myself and my family really working on narratives directly with like design companies, architectural firms, design and planning firms to be like, you really need to rethink this. I was honestly really hopeful for quite some time, but now it's just turning into kind of a realm of like they're using the language, but not listening to the words. And it's really frustrating. However, what that has resulted in is it's becoming a requirement through UNDRIP, United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, to have to include Indigenous people in any design process. And at first, this was like, oh my God, a huge win. I'm so excited. But then immediately after that, we started getting calls like right, left, and center. Everyone wanted us on a project. But I'm like, why the sudden interest? Obviously, there's not enough Indigenous people to be on every single design project. Right. But I'm like, but now if like Indigenous person is on a design project, that person will get the job because they found an Indigenous person to be on the design project team, but that Indigenous person may not even have a real voice in the design process. And then what happens too is if maybe even they do have a real voice, the team is really sincere about their involvement. It's not just to get the project or just to get the team to look good on paper for their called requests for proposals for RFPs. Then it gets to the point where, you know, an Indigenous person has really shared their voice. They've really tried to include their community. They really tried to ameliorate the community engagement process, bring in more elders and different people that don't have a design background. And all these voices and all this work gets shared. But then at the end of it, what happens is called like value designed out. So for example, we're working on a project where we need to increase tree coverage by 50 to 80% in order to avoid heat doming on the site. Mm-hmm. But I won't name the project. But what happened is the project got turned down. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons is there was too many trees and they were going to block somebody's view. And you're like, wow, so all these elders, all this effort, all this community engagement, it just, at the end of it, got values designed out. Technically, the project is on pause. I'm not saying this is like 100% a loss, but it is an example of like, you can do all the community engagement in the world. You can all do all the studies in the world. You can have the greatest intention to design something effective. And then because the status quo is in place and there's no real incentive to implement or have integrity with all the people that you've engaged in the project and to deliver on the engagement, to deliver from what the community asks have been, or listen to the Indigenous design specialists on the team, it's, you can just design it out at the end of the process. And that's really scary to me right now.
Mm-hmm. And that seems so problematic from a variety of different positions, whether it's reconciliation, mm-hmm. climate change. Mm-hmm. I mean, why people don't like the look of a tree.
Yeah. Like, I'm sorry you can't see the ocean now, but and in the summertime, you're going to like be using your AC all day while people are like suffering on the street. I'm so sorry that that's your reality now. But I mean, well, it's a tree.
Like, right.
It'll help, I promise. But yeah, it's really frustrating. And yeah, like it really makes you think about and like really feel for all these communities. It's called community engagement fatigue, where a community gets engaged so much, but nothing actually gets done. That community learns that their involvement isn't valuable to the client or the government or whoever it is implementing these things. So then why would you ever trust? Like, why would you make the effort if you're not going to be heard and it's not going to be listened to and implemented? So then that's where all this like breakdown of trust is happening in the industry right now as well. And for me, it's like, I have to have the integrity to not do projects if I know the community is not going to be listened to at the end of it. Whereas some people are totally fine with, you know, making all this money, doing community engagement, knowing, or maybe not knowing, but eventually like it doesn't actually happen. Mm-hmm. And then that's where I'm so concerned with, I think there needs to be a shift from being like designers, which have really been taught throughout school to design for a certain demographic, like a very wealthy demographic. There's a lot of talk right now about how design is for the rich, design is for the wealthy. However, I think there needs to be a huge shift, you know, not just towards like Indigenous sovereignty, but also moving away from design to like advocacy. And that, you know, if a community member shares with you, like they have a real desire for like real change, and then you're like, okay, I'll listen to you, I'll put it on the plan, and that plan doesn't happen. Like, you know, whether it be because of you or because of another factor, I'm like, there has to be that shift from that moment to move towards advocacy instead of just being like, oh, sorry, like the design process didn't like work out, essentially.
Right. And I mean, we've been going through this together in some ways because you're involved in a project for Community, which mm-hmm. is an organization I'm on the board of. And part of that is also Indigiqueering. Mm-hmm. And this is a term that I wasn't really aware of until we started this work. But I know that you embody and reflect queerness in your work. We've talked, obviously, a lot about Indigiqueering at Community, whether it was in conversations with mm-hmm. you or outside of that. And it's something that we're now very passionate about now that we understand what this is mm-hmm. and why it's important. I think that organization is obviously not wanting to just get a design made and then scrap it and move forward with the project. There's an actual passion to move forward with it. But we're also facing a lot of challenges mm-hmm. in that process. Like, we wanted the whole space to be available for smudging, for instance. Mm-hmm. We wanted a lot of curves in the design, and that wasn't incorporated into the base building designs. Mm-hmm. And for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what a base building design is, that's sort of the design of the whole structure of the building before the tenants come in and design their own spaces. So I'm curious to know about the difficulties that you've come up against when dealing with projects like this, where you're trying to incorporate these elements, but you're also having to work around these elements that kind of get in the way of accomplishing that goal.
Yeah, I think that covers like almost the whole ethos of what we're trying to do. And I'm really glad we're bringing up this example. And it's almost like decolonizing is almost becoming this metaphor. And I feel like decolonize is something really specific. To me, it means dismantle the framework of dominion, which we won't get into on this podcast. But for anybody listening, just Google the framework of dominance or framework of dominion. It'll bring up a whole journey of information. But the digiquerying design has started becoming really, really important to me because queerness is so inherent to my cultural understanding of like who my people are, indigeneity, and the importance of designing spaces that are inherently queer is become like part of the whole goal of my work now, my research right now. And, you know, just learning really beautiful things and sharings that we've all kind of learned almost together, even through this like community process. Some of the research, like learning, you know, for example, that indigenous plants like cedar are two-spirit, is called dioecious and monoecious, I'm finding out. So monoecious being there's both genders in one tree or in one animal or one being, and then dioecious being kind of split genders in a similar community. So all these like monoecious plants like cedar, which is two-spirit, or oysters, which are born one gender and then switch genders like 2 years into their life and can switch back and forth. A lot of different clams, some of them never switch, some of them do switch. Like learning all these really beautiful things and realizing I can incorporate this into design, and that if you work directly with these kind of queer indigenous creatures and you can, you know, look at the color palette of an oyster and be like, wouldn't that be beautiful in a bathroom? Or look at the color palette of a cedar and be like, wow, it'd be so nice to have a room that kind of gives you that feeling of sitting with a cedar tree. And you're like, wow, I can really like embed queerness into spaces that even when it's not obvious, even when it's like there's not a queer person or a family member like right there with you, you can still feel supported by like the land itself when sometimes you don't feel supported by anyone else or seen. Meanwhile, the land sees you. And I think that's so powerful and profound. But like you said, when the base building is already designed in a colonial way, is it like, what can you do? And we actually talked about this with the community, about the community project before we even accepted it, where we knew that the base building had already been pre-designed. Mm-hmm. And normally it's actually a policy at my company that we don't take on projects where there's already been pre-designed that can't be changed.
Oh, interesting.
And we decided specifically with community that it was still important to do what we can with the space just to make sure that like, you know, like those principles are there and people feel supported even if like, you know, we can't change the walls maybe. So we still decided it was really important to do the project. But, you know, like we are really advocating now in the narrative that indigenous processes, concepts, design, ideas are literally at like pre-inception of a project, like right there with the developer, right there with the client, right there, you know, with the policy makers. It's like how early in the design process can we make sure indigenous concepts or indigiqueering is happening so that, you know, the building itself could have supported some of these ideas. And, you know, what you're talking about with the smudging, right? I found out that, like, for example, at my house, I'll smudge and the alarm will go off and every now and then like the fire truck shows up and it's like a huge disaster. And I feel like a lot of people that smudge have had like a similar experience. You're like, well, I don't want to like get like the fire truck involved and now they've just come for like no reason because I'm just trying to like cleanse my home and my spirit. And you're like, this is really frustrating for everyone and super triggering and like heightening. But you can actually get different kinds of fire detectors that are heat detecting instead of smoke detecting.
Mm.
And so it would be more appropriate, especially in buildings that have people that know, you know, have spiritual cultural beliefs that, you know, that have smudging in them, to have these like heat detecting smoke detect or yeah heat detecting detectors instead of smoke detecting detectors. And that's just like really thoughtful and really mindful of, you know, bringing back these cultural practices, and it's not, you know, kind of forced appropriation through necessity. And then that's what we were talking about, right, at community. But then because the building was already designed and they're like, oh, we don't have the capacity for like smoke in the building and we can't change the detectors that we chose and all the rest of it, and you're like, well, this isn't we can only change so much then if there's not going to be the flexibility to be able to shift this like base building that's been frustrating us.
Yeah, and I think some of the aspects were more frustrating than others too, because we sort of knew going in the columns are going to be square, and we have to figure out how to make them more rounded in, in the TI work or the tenant improvement aspect of the work. But there were other aspects like HVAC, which from my understanding was still being worked out when you first joined the project.
Right,
totally. And we had said from the beginning, we want smudging to be involved. And for some reason that was disregarded. And it wasn't until many months later that they said, oh, well, now the HVAC plan's finalized and we can't do that. So sorry.
You're totally right. I totally forgot. No, you're so right. And like, that's like the, that's what value designed out is. It's like somebody somewhere made a decision without communicating with the full team that either is too expensive or too like not status quo or too not due process. And then suddenly it's just like not happening. Meanwhile, like you said, it totally was part of like the initial conversations. And for those of you listening and not sure why we're so like adamant about having curved walls and like circular columns, it's because in a lot of our research at Sky Spirit Studio, residential schools were often designed very like linear hallways, very like I shape, H shapes, very central staircases, brick buildings, modern architectural style. And if you're going to design for Indigenous people, or just with like a trauma-informed lens and just being aware of how intergenerational trauma impacts Indigenous people and, you know, also like BIPOC people in general, a lot of buildings that are institutional are really triggering. And that's by design, and that's intentional by the people that created modern architecture. Modern architecture was intentionally designed to be assimilatory to culture, to BIPOC people, to people that have any sense of culture or identity. And modern architecture was inherently and intentionally designed to deculture in order to, quote unquote, move forward with evolutionary theory and all these like really racist concepts. So at Sky Spirit, to have a trauma-informed way of being, it's like, okay, we don't need the hallway to be super narrow and straight. We don't need the fluorescent lights to just be like blaring down on you. We don't, you know, we can design spaces that are different, that, you know, just because a white wall room is seen as professional, we don't have to agree with that. We can say a room that's professional is mindful, a room that's professional is trauma-informed, right? And a community, we're all so supportive of that. But like you said, this base building. So it's like, okay, how do we retrofit or like indigiqueer this like base building that's so linear?
Right. And speaking of BIPOC people, more generally, we began this conversation before this podcast started. We had a meeting and you said, I really want to talk about BIDC. So can you explain what BIDC is and why that's so important to you?
Yeah, of course. So BIDC is the Black and Indigenous Design Collective. We're a collective of Black and Indigenous designers that all came together specifically after the murder of George Floyd. And we really wanted to do something real and that reflected systemic change to us. And we embarked on this journey of solidarity. So started the project and the process with my very close friends and colleagues, Crystal Perabou and Divine Endemier. And they're Divine is a landscape architect and Crystal is an amazing public art curator and planner. And we've really just been working together to one, understand Black and Indigenous solidarity, but to really try and address that statistic I talked about earlier about how less than 1% of Black and Indigenous people in what is colonially known as Canada are in design or in spatial design. And the real goal is to try and create more Black and Indigenous leadership in these fields, to really shift the conversations, to really intentionally address the critical tokenization that's happening right now. Because one, of capacity, but two, just the system is being effective and making it difficult for us to do real change and real work. So BIDC is really focusing this year on community building. And in the following years, we're really going to be focusing on capacity building. We've been educating Black and Indigenous youth and industry professionals and emerging professionals. We really just want our communities to have the tools to like advocate for themselves. But also, like, you know, instead of having to rely on clients who are often the city of Vancouver or developers who kind of inherently already have a stake in colonialism and already benefiting from colonialism, so they have less desire to, you know, make these changes or to address like values designing out really important critical elements that would support, you know, these real missions to be more trauma-informed, to be more culturally sustainable and like, you know, respect sovereignty. So like, wouldn't it be so much more incredible if we could just design our own buildings and just, you know, really support Indigenous sovereignty, really support Black liberation and design, and not have to like fight a client tooth and nail to like make it happen.
Right. And I mean, it sounds like solidarity and intersectionality are very important to you. So beyond sort of the obvious that we need to treat each other with respect, why is that such an important aspect of you and your work?
Solidarity is so deeply important to me. I think I'm really fortunate. My dad, you know, really radicalized me as a kid, and he really made sure I grew up on stories of AIM, the American Indigenous Movement, and the Black Panthers, and how they worked together. And those stories were always so inspiring to me. And then as I continued to grow up, and I went and did my undergrad in environmental design at UBC, and then went and did my master's in sustainable urbanism at University College London, my mom's an archivist and my dad's an oral historian. So we all kind of worked together. And whilst I was at these universities, we would, through different projects that I was working on, get access to archives. It's a lot easier to, you know, anybody can access archives, but it's a lot easier when you're like, I'm at a university working on a project. Can I get a letter from a university and get access to these like private archives? It's just, that's how colonialism works. They're like, oh, of course, like institution to institution, we got you, right? So went with my parents, went on these research projects. My parents got a grant from First Peoples Cultural Council to research our family history, but also research colonialism. So we went on this like 10-year research project, essentially, and with my parents, which I think is why we have such a good relationship. We're all both, like, all three of us are like so invested in like knowledge and have a real passion for it. But yeah, we went to all the maritime museums in Vancouver. We went to all the maritime museums, the British Museum, the Greenwich Museum, the Sainsbury Museum out in London. And we really were like, what is colonialism? Like, what is this thing that we're really dealing with and really struggling with to try and dismantle? And through that process, I learned about, for those of you Googling the framework of dominance and the framework of dominion, you'll see, maybe you'll see the papal bulls, Dum Dupersas, Romanus Pontifex, and Inter Caetera from the Vatican in the 1400s and 1500s. And those papal bulls were a papal directive to exert dominion essentially over the world. The first one essentially being dominion over pagans. So kind of this process of colonization and disrupting ancestral knowledge really started in Europe. So really started, you know, cutting off, you know, European people from our own culture. Like, I'm Eastern European too, and have understandings of how that history has affected my Hungarian side. But then the papal bulls then going and, you know, really starting the genocides that happened in Africa and the slave trade. And then it came over to South America with the genocide of the Mayan and Incan and Aztec and South American indigenous peoples. And then it came up here to North America and started the genocides here. So these papal bulls and the, you know, doctrine of discovery, the framework of dominance and dominion really became this in like monster of a colonial project that has really truly affected all of us. But learning that, and also looking at Black Panther, looking at AIM, looking at, you know, at Standing Rock, how much like solidarity happened between different groups there, I really started realizing like colonialism is global in scope. And, you know, working together, you know, in Africa, they've been dealing with colonialism for longer than we have on the West Coast. On the West Coast, it's been about almost 300 years of colonization, whereas in other places in the world, it's been like over 1,000. So I'm like, why don't I go and ask people and cultures that have been dealing with it for thousands of years and be like, what have you figured out? And then very fortunately on our side, or sorry, that's the wrong wording, but not fortunate, but just because of the fact that we've had colonization for less time, we have maintained a lot of our cultural practices in my family, which I'm very grateful for my ancestors and my family for. So then there's teachings there too. So being able to have these like cross-cultural sharings of how to address colonialism has been really profound to me. And learning a lot about like Afrofuturism, for example, and applying that to Indigenous futurism, but always maintaining that like Afrofuturism was created by Black activists for Black community to imagine Black people in Black futures. And like, that's such a powerful statement. So it's like, okay, if we work in solidarity with each other, we can create that, you know? And I think that's why solidarity is so important to me.
Absolutely. I really need to recommend this podcast to my dad, because he's a Latin American historian. So I think he will be absolutely fascinated with the discussion. And I'm curious to know, you talk on the website, or the organization talks on the website, about traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK, and story of place. And I'm curious to know how those are incorporated into your designs.
Yeah, absolutely. So tech, we actually call it, is
tech.
Our, yeah, okay. Like our technology,
yeah,
with a K. So traditional ecological knowledge is the understanding that the way Indigenous ways of life are inherently innovative. There's a lot of stereotype that, you know, Indigenous people were hanging out with like sticks and mud and wood, and like it's a really annoying stereotype because it's just like really untrue. But more than that, like I've dealt with a lot of racism around like, oh, like Indigenous people, like we gave you cell phones, we gave you this, we gave you that. You should be so grateful for colonization, which is like the most unreal statement. Meanwhile, everyone should go and watch Neptune Frost. It's one of the most incredible movies I've ever seen, but it really talks about how these technologies, like phones, right, we're finding out it's all from exploitation. It's all from Africa in the first place. All these materials are from exploitative like ways of being. Mm-hmm. And all of these like land thefts and occupations are just ways to create oppression. And a lot of that oppression is now through technology and innovation. And a lot of these things are what, you know, the like really racist narratives are trying to say, like as Indigenous people, we should be grateful for.
Right. Because a lot of it's based on like slavery, child labor,
really,
things that people don't realize are still going on or that they're participating in.
Mm-hmm. And then I attended this really incredible talk about Indigenous technologies. And one of the really profound teachings that I came across was how, you know, in Indigenous cultures, we believe everything has a spirit. So the stones have a spirit, the trees have a spirit. And then this elder was like, a laptop has a spirit. I was like, what do you mean? Like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah, this microphone has a spirit. And I was like, what? You and I was like struggling with the concept, but I really, really thought about it. And he was like, yeah, all these materials are from the earth. Mm-hmm. And so then he said, you imagine our ancestors have a relationship-based model of interacting and designing technology. And Western ideations are a dominion-based way of interacting with technology. And he said that, you know, this cross-cultural sharing that could have happened that wasn't based in occupation, wasn't based in land theft, an Indigenous way of building a cell phone would be inherently different than a Western way of building a cell phone, even though all these materials and technologies and stuff are from the earth in the first place. Like, it's all from, you know, like, you're like, oh, I'm going to go and get cobalt, but you're actually going to have a relationship with that person. It's going to be a reciprocal, harmonious, and, like, appropriate power dynamic. Whereas, like, now we're dealing with, like, literal genocide in the same context. And I'm like, oh, that's really profound. And then he was explaining how all of our technologies have always worked with the human spirit, as opposed to a lot of Western technologies are really against the human spirit. Like, how many of us are, like, addicted to our phones? Like, how many of us are dealing with information overload and all these things? But if you contextualize a technological world and way of being as not just based on, you know, the material technologies, but the technologies of understanding the human mind, the technologies of understanding the human spirit. And then that's really where, at least in my culture, we really get into like oral history and the concept that the way that we share histories, the way that we share physics, the way that we share science in my culture is storytelling based. And there's so much like evidence-based theory on how memory is better served in a storytelling way. I think if you look up like memory palaces, for example, or, you know, like Aristotle, which who not my favorite human in the world, but Aristotle wrote about memory palaces. It's not just, it's a global concept, but a lot of Indigenous cultures use, it's called memetics or memory keeping technologies to memorize thousands and thousands of years of information as if, you know, that person was there in that moment, like 30,000 years ago. So for me, it's like, there's so much technology that's part of an Indigenous way of being, but because of stereotypes, because of racism, you know, there's just like these blocks to that like cultural sharing or like reclaiming of like ancestral knowledge that makes it difficult. But I'll just share one of my favorite technologies is a cedar hat. I should have worn one today, but for this example. But for those of you that have seen cedar hats, there's the northern style hats, which are kind of the more peaked mountain looking ones, which are from up north. And then the Coast Salish ones are more mushroom cap shape like this. But cedar is naturally antibacterial. So it'll get the mosquitoes away from you. When wet, the material expands. So it becomes more watertight or airtight, sorry. And then it allows heat to not escape so that you actually are maintaining your temperature. But then when it's dry out or hot out, they become thinner and allow heat and air to escape. And so it cools you down. So by wearing these cedar hats, it's actually a cooling technology for your body. And they're still effective. I haven't found anything more effective. I can swim in the water with them. I can, you know, do my day about them. Some of them are woven so tight you can actually boil water inside them. Like they're real technologies, but they're just made out of plant material and plant fiber.
That's fascinating. I mean, I went to a longhouse when I was in elementary school and we did cedar weaving and we learned some facts about it, but I've just learned so much more from that little,
Yeah, my dad shared all that with me, but mainly he shared it with me because I like totally broke his cedar hat. So one of my scolding teachings, but he's like, you need to respect this more. I'm like, I'm sorry. But yeah, I was like wearing his cedar hat all summer one summer because I was just like, this is so great. I feel like culturally connected. And then I just wore it so much that it totally broke down and like fell apart. And my dad was like, you have to learn how to remake this now. And I was like so upset and like, oh no, like what have I done? But he's like, no, like this is the point. Like he's like, it's supposed to fall apart so that you now have to learn how to put it back together. He's like, that's how it works. I was like, oh, okay, like I get it. And then as I was like learning how to fix it, he was like sharing all this like temperature technology with me, which is a really Coast Salish thing. Like we had a lot of technologies to regulate our temperature in the climate. I'm not sure how many of us have chosen the wrong jacket out in Vancouver and you're like, oh no, now it's sunny. Oh no, now it's raining. Why is it snowing right now? Like it's just so temperamental here that our people like really figured out how to like wear the appropriate clothing or like use appropriate lotions to like handle fluctuating temperatures and humidity.
Right. And it seems like so much of design is sort of coming back to these natural elements. Like I think about how I worked at a ski store for 8 years and there was all these synthetic materials, but we ended up moving away from those synthetic materials and saying, well, merino wool is actually a really good product because it regulates your temperature. It cools you down in the summer, warms you up in the winter. So it sounds like that's same type of thing with these cedar hats. And, you know, we think about technology as artificially creating things almost, but you almost can never artificially create something that's going to be better than what nature provides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the knowledge required to like create that like alchemy or like transformation to like get it to be as effective as it can be. Yeah. And like you mentioned wool and like wool weaving is really important to Salish, like Coast Salish people. We like have woven like mountain goat fur and Salish woolly dog fur. And yeah, wearing like wool weavings is like really important to our culture. So it's again, a temperature regulating material.
And when it comes to like the design of buildings, right? Getting back to that whole piece, I remember this conversation that we had, one of the first meetings that I was in, where you were presenting was around barnacles.
Oh, yeah.
and how incredible barnacles are, right? And their barnacles are queer. And then we were thinking about how to weave that into the design process of the building. So what makes it so important for you to bring all these natural elements into a building like the one that we're working on with Community?
Totally. So in my mind, a lot of these technologies are just better technologies. I think it's a very indigenous quality to choose the most effective tool for what you're trying to do, whether that be a cell phone, whether that be cedar, whether that be whatever it needs to be to create the result, the community-based result that you're looking for, a land-based result you're looking for. It's just whatever makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with, you know, learnings about like longhouses and studying how longhouses are built, again, longhouses are built out of cedar planks of cedar. We were able to acquire these cedar planks by not chopping down the trees. There's a way that you can treat a cedar tree where you can take off a plank of it, allow it to cure over the year so the tree can kind of like get a little bit of its bark back, take the plank and the tree continues to live. So like, again, incredible. But then what's interesting is that once that plank is taken, it's not like the tree isn't affected. The tree will die sooner than a tree that hasn't had that effect. However, as it decays, it's now decaying into a cave because of the way that the plank was taken. And now that cave is a home for a bear or a wolf or different creatures in the forest. So now you're actually creating housing for your like animal kin. So it's a whole system that's effective because now you're like, okay, now I know that all the dens are kind of in these areas that we've like created over time. So obviously like these certain animals will move into those spaces. It's just like an incredible land management technique. And then you take those planks, which are naturally breathable, naturally flexible. It's called aerobic architecture for the architecture nerds, but essentially it was very aerobic architecture. And then the way that we created these kind of like curtain walls, they're called, is that we would kind of stack the planks overlapping over each other using nettle withes or like twine, essentially, that was almost comparable to like steel twine in a way. And by the way that we tied them, you were able to articulate each plank an inch above, an inch below, or perfectly airtight with each other.
Huh.
And then by being able to do that, you could actually completely control the temperature, air quality, humidity, and dryness inside the building.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Right? Yeah. So you could reconfigure, because we always had like hearth fires kind of in the center of our buildings. But sometimes you'd want a smaller family fire off to the corner. And sometimes you want like a giant, huge fire for like ceremonies in the center. And then based on where the fire needed to be, you could articulate the entire building, the roof, the walls, like everything to manage the smoke for you.
Huh.
And I was speaking with Aaron Nelson Moody, who I consider one of my elders. He's like, I'm not an elder. I'm like, sorry. But you're like, you're so knowledgeable. You're an elder to me now. But Aaron Nelson Moody, who's done a lot of research as well, he told me that his relatives' relatives, like a few couple generations ago, remembered growing up inside these buildings, and they remember that they weren't smoky, and that you said you were in a longhouse. Mm-hmm. It was smoky, right?
It was a while ago, and yeah. I don't remember, but I don't recall there being ventilation.
Right. So a lot of longhouses that are built today aren't necessarily being built exactly like they were, you know, in the pre-1850s. Whereas pre-1850s, you had this articulated wall concept, whereas now the walls are fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of, you know, kind of quote-unquote modern longhouses are not actually traditional. And, you know, you put a fire inside those and everything gets really smoky and everyone kind of brings eye drops and kind of deals with it how they need to.
Okay.
Whereas back in the day, their smoke wasn't an issue at all. Our people even had a form of concrete that we were able to use. And for those that have gone to design or architecture school, the inception of concrete by the Romans is considered like peak civilization. It's like, we invented concrete too. We just thought it was a less effective material in such a hydrologically active like land. Like there's so many rivers, there's so much rain, like the amount of potholes that like show up are potholes that show up or like any king tide will just like knock over any like the seawall. Mm-hmm. It's you know, drainage is a huge issue in the city because of all the concrete in it. Whereas our people were like, okay, we use the concrete for inside, and then we use canoes and we use the rivers for our roads outside. So we work directly with the hydrology of the land. But yeah, we had concrete, and Aaron Nelson Moody's ancestors' ancestors were talking about how they remember mopping the floors and, you know, what it was like to be inside one of these spaces. So to roundabout answer your question, it's so important to me to reincorporate these design concepts because they're the most effective design or the most effective way of designing on this land. And that's been proven for like thousands and thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's important for people to understand is it's not about just we're trying to make it look a certain way. It's totally about how effectively the materials actually work.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And we're really Coast Salish people have always lived in high density housing. My dad likes to joke that we just had sideways high rises. And, you know, we're like a high rise city, not by choice by our people, but we are a high rise city. But we've become extremely good at high density living through, you know, a human way of life around thousands of people. Every 4 years during the winter, we'd host 10,000 guests all winter at the village of Huaihuai pre-1850s. So Huaihuai is Stanley Park right by Lumberman's Arch. There is a longhouse there called Taihei, which was 60 feet long. And that at Jericho, which was Ayalmoch in Fomasquiam, Ayalmoch had a longhouse. It was 1,000 feet long. And like, you're like, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Like, that's a major structure. And
that's
then
huge.
There were villages at, you know, Ayalmoch and Huaihuai and Sesnam in Musqueam territory that were large scale villages that had hundreds of people living inside these homes or these like sideways high rises. So we've learned for many, many years how to effectively live in like high density living.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those concepts still apply to the way that the city is now.
Right. And I mean, speaking about the local land, land back is something that we hear quite a lot these days. And I think people have different ideas of what land back means when it comes to design work, which can often only really be undertaken by people who, under our current system, own property. There's this fear that land back means those properties or people's homes, people's businesses is going to be seized from them, mm-hmm. I guess. And I don't know what your perspective is on sort of that interpretation or what land back means to you. So it would be really great if you could explain to the audience mm-hmm. what land back means and sort of maybe alleviate people's concerns or
I think land back, I'm a very literal person. It's mm-hmm. very important to me that when I say a thing, that's what it is. But you know, obviously respecting metaphor and how people have used land back as a metaphor, which I don't necessarily always agree with, but land back to me is literal land back to Indigenous sovereign people and families. Mm-hmm. It can get complex in the sense that for example, with the Squamish people, my own nation, before 1923, there was actually over 28 individual villages that were governed by individual families. Mm-hmm. So before 1923, land back means, you know, giving the land back to those families and those like ancestral governance systems, which I personally still believe in. I just recognize that it's really complex. And now the conversation is land back to the Squamish, Ohomeo, the Squamish Nation, which amalgamated from 16 of those villages into the Squamish Nation as we know it today, which I also respect. And I think centralizing these conversations is important as well, but decentralizing also has an importance to me. But it's all, again, about right relationship. So there's a lot of dynamics, a lot of complexity, but it's really not that complex. It's just give the land back to the rightful Indigenous people whose land that you're occupying. And then when that happens, I think it shows a lot of integrity and understanding to not be fearful and to be understanding that, you know, you've been participating in occupation, illegal occupation of Indigenous territory. You are participating in genocide by doing so. And I think the more comfortable we can get with that and, you know, not taking it to a place of fear, which I personally believe is the ego acting up. Because if you're afraid and you're panicking and you're like in so much a fear of your life getting upended, when meanwhile your life relies on the fact that Indigenous people have been dispossessed and their lives have been actually upended by this process, I think that's just a way to center, you know, your own feelings to not actually like move forward and move through and understand the real power dynamic at play. However, I understand in the sense that we're all here now. So what do we do? I personally believe that if you're going to really truly support Indigenous sovereignty, you're really going to understand what that means to each individual person you're responsible to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, reinstating ancestral governance is also reinstating your own relationship to ancestral governance. Like, who are you to these Indigenous families? Who are you to these Indigenous nations? And you have a role to play. You know, it's not like, you know, your home gets suddenly given back to the Indigenous nation it rightfully belongs to. But, you know, like, do you not have skills that you can offer this nation? Do you not have a profession that could support this Indigenous nation? Do you not have a way to, you know, integrate yourself into an Indigenous way of being as opposed to a Western colonial occupation? So these are all things to think about. He's like, why does your world end when ours is reinstated? I'm always so curious about that. But there is an example. Haida Gwaii recently just won title to their entire island. I'm so proud of my Haida relatives. Mm-hmm. And they were given the option to kick all the white people out. And they said, no, some of them can stay. So again, that's not my story to tell. But I think speaking with people that were really part of that movement, and I just like want to share that I'm so proud of my Haida relatives for being able to, you know, really get their land back. And a lot of different nations, like the Squamish Nation, are starting to get land back. Famasquam, Tsleil-Waututh, like, MSC Development Corps and Hiam Housing and Nshkai Development Corps are all part of these like land back conversations. They are complex, but it really is happening right now. So I think, again, it's really important to ask ourselves, like, yeah, why does my world end when Indigenous sovereignty is reinstated? Mm-hmm. And, you know, just questioning your positionality.
Right. So it's possible to sort of say, I'm going to put my ego aside. I'm going to give my land back to the people whose land was stolen from them. And that doesn't mean I no longer have a place to live.
100%. Like, we're obviously I can't speak for anyone else. I think it is important to have different opinions on this. But the way that, you know, I've been taught urban design, the way that I've been taught governance, everyone has a role to play. And I think, yeah, if you think about it, like, what does it take to run a government? What does it take to run a city? What does it take to run a community? You need everyone, right? And, you know, moving away from this like dominion-based individualistic way of life towards, you know, like a community-based, like kinship, relationship building way of life, I think is that we have to, right? Like to address climate change, to address like all these different genocides happening around the world, to like really truly address colonialism, which has been around since before the 1400s, like 1200 AD, the conceptualizations even happening around 1000 AD. Like this is like something that we've all been affected by. Mm-hmm. And I think we can work together. And I know that's a really positive way of thinking, but it's also true if we want to build community with each other.
Yeah. And I mean, I try to end a lot of these podcasts with what can our audience do to give back? So when it comes to something like land back, let's say someone owns a condo. Mm-hmm. Can they just say, I'm going to give my condo to this nation? Or would we be talking more in terms of, you know, the government is giving this larger swath of land away? Because mm-hmm. I know there's implications in terms of like, okay, now you've gifted someone this thing, but it has like property taxes associated right. with it and strata fees associated mm-hmm. with it and all these other sort of concepts that may not be in place mm-hmm. if an indigenous, I don't know if you'd say an organization, because I don't think that would be right, but like a band would mm-hmm. would own the land under the building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's so complex. It's really case by case. Some bands have, I'm pretty sure this conversation, people have been like, can I give my land to you? And the nation is like, we really appreciate the sentiment. We just need some time to like figure out the due process of how that works. Right. And then you're like, oh, okay, maybe I can offer like support with the capacity side of things. You know, it's not like, oh, like I'm going to, yeah, it's not going to be this like one major thing and suddenly all the land is, I think it's really complex. Mm-hmm. And I really want to focus on like the relationship building and positionality, because like each area of land is dealing with different layers of colonization, different layers of like zoning and zoning bylaws and all this stuff. And, you know, when you do give the land back, what happens to the land, right? And I think every nation deserves all the self-determination in the world. But for me personally, like if the land is coming back to my nation, I really want the land to be designed in an indigenous way. But you know what happens when there's not enough indigenous designers, there's not enough indigenous host nation people with urban planning backgrounds to like, you know, plan these spaces, then, you know, we have the land back, but the land is still being colonized. Mm-hmm. And that is really, really worrying to me. And that's why I really want more indigenous people in design, and I want more non-indigenous people to support indigenous leadership going into design. So yes, like maybe you're not giving the land back, give the land back, but maybe you're not giving the land back, but you're, you know, supporting an indigenous person going to design school. You're supporting an indigenous person becoming a lawyer. You're like, to me, capacity building is so important. And yeah, like maybe there's a way you can donate to the Black Indigenous Design Collective, donate to BIDC, you know, just really pay attention to different, lawyers or groups that are like really truly doing land back, and just be like, where can I help? Like, where can I support? And there's so many different ways to support and be a part of these movements. I think it's just about having integrity, being able to be really uncomfortable, being able to, you know, dismantle the framework of dominance and dominion, and dismantle the concepts of dominion that we've kind of been taught since childhood in these dominion-based systems, and really upending that and just being in community, being around each other, not falling for like white saviorism. You know, it's like really nice to support indigenous person, but don't white savior them. Like there's so many different layers to that too. Yeah, it's really complex, but also it's really simple. Like land back is indigenous sovereignty, and there's the action of giving the land back, but then there's actually supporting indigenous sovereignty. And there's a lot more there as well.
Right. And tying that conversation in with your work with Sky Spirit, what is your hope for the future of Sky Spirit?
I'm honestly really hoping to expand. Like I said, it's really important to me that there becomes an industry of Black and Indigenous design professionals really working together and doing this work in solidarity. And in order to do that, you need an effective structure. You need viable career paths for people. You need a living wage. You need an office that does things differently. You need you know, if my office says that we're like decolonial, then it's really important to me that, like, you know, people working for us in the future are able to be in community, are able to support their own land back initiatives in whatever nations that they're from. But being able to say those things and have these really like positive dreams is like one thing. But then being able to actually have like a safe, culturally knowledgeable and rooted like business practice is really complicated, and doing it the right way is so important to me. It takes a really long time to get these things like in place in the right way, or have the right capacity, or like make the right partnerships, try not to be tokenized in the whole process. And but yeah, for me, I guess my like ultimate dream is to expand Sky Spirit to support. We have a methodology, we have a design methodology. I'd love to be able to support other nations that aren't just you know, Coast Salish. I'd love to support going to like Aotearoa and like communicating and collaborating with designers over there, or going into like the plains and supporting different Indigenous nations over there, and in their own way, right? Like not being like, not just continuing that like settler mindset of like go and like make it this thing, but actually be like, hey, like these are what I've found have helped me. Let's like see how like maybe some of these tools can work for you and some of them won't, and just like support each other and just be in solidarity. But yeah, for me, as you know, an entrepreneur, it's important to me to, yeah, offer real career paths to Black Indigenous people, people that want to be in these design industries to support sovereignty. And if you can like viably do that and create a really high quality of life and support, you know, all these initiatives, and maybe being able to like build housing for houseless people, being able to like really, I don't know, create like wellness centers that are like Indigenous based, or building entire communities based on like Indigenous values that are, some of them could be closed communities, but like other communities could be open to like any race, any walk of life, to come and live in those spaces. Building community centers based on, again, like cultural values and ancestral values and cultural sharing. But for me, I have a really strong background in environmental design, and environmental design is one of, I think, in my opinion, the most powerful design tools to address landslides, to address wildfires, to address flooding in your communities. Like there are design solutions to every one of those natural disasters, and that if you work directly with Indigenous people, we can implement them really effectively. So I think for me, it's just like creating a really strong team, creating really livable careers for BIPOC people, and then also creating really effective design solutions to address climate change, to address like more and more immigrants coming into our territories, and like housing them, but in like the right way and with like cultural intention. And yeah, just like really focusing on real solutions, I think is important to me.
And is there anything that we haven't touched on yet that you think would be really important to discuss before we wrap things up?
I think there's so many important things, but I really feel like we talked about a lot of really important topics to me. And again, solidarity. I think the most important thing is self-education and doing what you can. But yeah, please consider reaching out to the Black Indigenous Design Collective or donating or supporting as a volunteer. You know, next year will be a lot more full on, so we'll need as much support as we can get. And if you're Indigenous, or you know, have Indigenous people in your community, please let them know that at Sky Spirit, we're really thinking about how to create more careers for people interested in design and supporting more Indigenous people to get into design. So again, please just like reach out. Part of the design movement would be amazing. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. This has been a Social Justice Podcast. I'm your host, Nicholas Burling. I've been joined today by Kasukalau for a conversation about Indigenous design with your organization, Sky Spirit.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And Paul Squall and Hoyt Matlath, Shenkwem and Tomi.
You've been listening to a Social Justice Podcast hosted by Nicholas Burling, brought to you by The Flag Shop, and inspired by a Social Justice Coloring Book.